This is me not singing. Are you singing?
I'm not singing either.
Nobody's singing.
This is the worst open ever.
Good morning.
Hi.
Back in Bergen.
Yeah.
And how's the weather like?
The weather in Bergen has been amazing. You chose yesterday, possibly one of the, I don't know if it's one of the best days of the year, but it was a super fine day. There was no wind, it was sunny, it was beautiful, it was warm. Well, it wasn't warm. It was like 8 or 10 degrees, but it was atypical, perhaps based on the previous discussions.
Yeah, I were in Oslo
Yeah.
yesterday, Monday as well.
I heard it was snowing.
Yeah, but yesterday it was nice. I was mostly inside, but weather talk can be really boring,
Well, we should decide not to do that anymore then. Like, we should just open with singing instead every week. Yeah, I don't think so.
Right, should we just jump right into follow-up?
Do it.
I did my homework.
Thank
A
you.
bit late, but I did it.
It's cool.
I read the thing.
I'll deduct 10%.
What was the thing? What was what? Oh, it's gonna be one of those episodes. Yeah, what was the thing?
The thing, the legibility thing. So to recap, I recommended a piece about legibility and about how there are lots of layers and systems and complex things that are often illegible to us. Often one can't perceive them. And because of that, it leads to kind of basic failures of thinking and dealing with information because there's so many layers of it that you're not taking into account. And I talked a little bit about how it might have to do with Sapir-Whorf and how the more you understand the language, the more legible things become to you, partly because a lot of cultural information is transmitted like that, but probably also for other reasons. It was a very half-assed theory, but that was where I went with it. And then you read the piece, I guess.
Yeah, and I guess this is a bit cute, but I didn't find the piece very legible.
That's funny. Why not?
I don't think it wasn't that good writing. It
Okay.
didn't sort of introduce many of the. It took a while for me to sort of get what this was about.
Okay.
Perhaps it was a bit stream of consciousness-ish.
Yeah, maybe. I don't remember having that problem with it, but maybe I'm just being kind of
Maybe you're just smarter than me.
oh no. I don't think that's the reason.
Or perhaps it was the lack of context. If you have read this author before.
Yeah, like it's hard for me to go back to the state of not having read it and look at it with fresh eyes. So I think I was just so
But
blown away by the central kind of
is this a
concept.
blog that you follow or something?
No, but I've come across this stuff a little bit before. But
Yeah.
like it's once you know a thing and once you understand a thing, it's really difficult to go back to the beginner's mind, right, of not understanding that. So I can't go back there with this particular concept.
And yeah, but what I did get from it, because it became better during the text, I
Or
think.
you became smarter during the text.
Perhaps. Because there were this sort of these bullet points, and I think it was an example of high modernism, the high modernism recipe or something.
Yeah,
Is
authoritarian high modernism.
look at the complex and confusing reality, such as the social dynamics of an old city, fail to understand all the subtleties of how the complex reality works. And here's a line that I highlighted in the paper. Attribute that failure to the irrationality of what you are looking at, rather than your own limitations. And generally, this is perhaps not a good thing.
Say more.
But it reminded me about one of my realizations being a student. And that was the point where you realized that perhaps it isn't you that are stupid, but perhaps this person that you are reading isn't that great at explaining things.
Yeah.
Right?
It's often tempting to assume that it's you.
It is. So that point kind of contradicts the point of this text, but sometimes reality are irrational and complex and illegible. Because this piece, I think it tries to communicate that it is indeed you that haven't understood the reality, right?
Yeah, that's kind of the central premise, right? Is that you will probably never understand the reality in a way that would allow you to faithfully reproduce it.
But it also assumes that behind your the perceived complexity, i.e. the perceived complexity, there are rationality or systems and so on. They are just...
Hidden.
But I don't think we can assume that always.
You mean sometimes it's just chaos?
Yeah.
That's going to be a problem for me as a language learner.
But then again, it also reminded me about Weber.
Okay.
Which we have mentioned before.
Say more though.
So the thing with Max Weber, he proposed a more nuanced model for rationality. So, before, we used to think of organizations and rationality in terms of efficiency or profitability. Is that a word?
Profitability?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so on. And when organizations or social systems are doing things that contradicts or not answers to those measures, we tend to think of them as rational or non-rational.
Right.
But the point Weber had is that there are different types of rationalities.
They don't all have to be rigid and structured. And
yeah.
Yeah. Now we're walking into kind of multiple intelligences territory as well. Maybe. That's another day.
So, yeah, it also comes down to how we deal with complexity, I think, and what model you bring to it. And I think the point there is the so-called high modernism authoritarian high modernism model is perhaps not sufficient always.
Yeah, to kind of steer this back to the whole like language and culture thing, I would say that languages are often taught in a way that is kind of authoritarian, high modernist. Mm. Like, here are some grammar rules and you will learn them. Here are some ways that the language works and you will learn them. And there are some exceptions and you will learn those, but we'd prefer not to have exceptions. Swedish, where they've kind of taken out, I think, a lot of the irregularities over time deliberately. Now I'm wondering if that's a very kind of authoritarian, well, is it authoritarian? Yeah, it's kind of authoritarian, high modernist approach maybe to language. Let's have fewer irregularities. Esperanto. That's a whole other thing, though.
Mm.
Esperanto is like the hand-knitted version of that. You can buy it on Etsy.
But nobody does.
Oh.
Yeah, and I believe that we will perhaps come back to this somewhat later in this episode.
Okay.
Mm.
I don't know, but that sounds encouraging. Okay. Hi, you've just tuned into the Philosophy Hour.
Today we are talking about Pascal and Plato.
No pressure.
Yeah.
That's a physics joke. You're welcome.
Yeah. Let's change gears.
Okay. Metal gears? Solid metal gears?
Solid metal gears.
Solid metal bagpiping gears.
Yeah, bagpipes. I think we came a bit hard down on bagpipes.
Well, I was, I guess, neutral. You said you didn't hate it.
Yeah, I think...
You're just trying to be diplomatic?
So,
Oh, diplomatic pause.
Apparently, we have some bagpipes enthusiasts among our audience.
Who knew? They're big nerds, so it comes as no surprise.
But I believe you were a bit dickish on Twitter about it. Don't you? Or perhaps...
Were we? Wait, what did I say?
This is a podcast where we read aloud Twitter timelines.
I know, it's pretty compelling. Mark Gould sent us lots of videos of people piping.
Yeah, and you sent him a cake piping video and so on.
Well,
it was just sort of dismissive.
I was trying to help. Links in the show notes.
Yeah. We got some videos.
Yeah.
With piping.
Yeah, we should link to those. They're great. There is some very metal, almost metal piping, says Mark, and he's right in there.
But I don't think it's allowed to call your bagpiping music group Red Hot Chili Pipers.
I thought that was a great name. And then Mike Smith sent us some bagpipe techno. I wasn't totally sold on that being techno, but I was entertained.
You don't like techno?
No, I just wasn't convinced it was super techno-ish music, maybe. Hmm. I don't know. But I'm not a huge techno fan either. I don't know. I can't deal with genre anymore. Techno seems like such a 30 years ago or 20 years ago kind of music definition. I don't know what we call that now. Apparently I have to do something.
Is that Google goals?
Life goals.
Review your to-do list. But Mark Gold, he sent us a video with this... folk musician.
Right.
Catherine Tickle.
Great name.
And the video he sent was an arrangement for the Norwegian Hardanger fiddle.
Right.
And she talks about it, the instrument, and she makes a point that due to the... This is an 8-string fiddle.
I know, I've wanted that, one since I was about 11.
That seems perhaps... I struggle for a word, but...
Excessive?
Yeah, it's not like you have to play 8 strings.
Right, you play 4 and the other 4 resonate, basically, and harmonics come out.
Yeah.
There's guitars that do that, right? Or something like that, where they have strings that just resonate that you don't play?
Probably.
I think so.
The 12-string guitar, you would play all the strings.
Oh, okay. Maybe I'm
thinking
something else.
They're just laid up double. But, well, there. If you can think of it, there is a guitar for it.
True, true. Pictures to follow.
And the point she made about the Hardanger fiddle is that the music tends to be a bit droney.
Mm, like bagpipes.
Yeah, exactly. So I also watched a couple of videos of her playing the bagpipe. And what was fascinating, it was not your usual bagpipe.
It'd be Northumbrian pipes, right? Because that's where she's from.
Yes, it was like the chicken dance bagpipe.
Right.
So you have the air pump under your arm.
Right.
You use that for blowing air into the...
The coordination required to do this.
And it's fascinating.
Yeah. Did it sound better to you than the sort of full-on Scottish bagpipes, which you do, by the way, you have a bag under your arm as well, but they're a little different.
It did. And it looked a lot better. Because the kind of chin you get from...
Yeah.
Playing.
That's not a good look, is it? Right. Drone music. Done that. Cheese slicing. We return to the perennial theme of the cheese slicer. After recent discussions, I could no longer contain myself, and I had to ask our colleagues for feedback on how many of them had actually injured themselves. So we got some feedback following the carrot challenge. We got some feedback from people going, yeah, I'm not going to do that. Like, I'll just end up in ribbons. And so I polled our colleagues how many of them had actually managed to injure themselves using a cheese slicer. And the answers I got were that of those who replied, 13 had never injured themselves with a cheese slicer, which sounds good until you hear that 18 of them had, but only a little bit, or not very often. Two further had done it, like, properly, and one person had to go to the doctor. So there you have it, folks. Data. These are people who invented the cheese slicer and then use it for self-harm. Could you not, like, fit a safety guard on this thing, or...
How would that look?
It would look pretty terrible, but, you know, it would be approved in Britain.
But do you have them at all in Britain?
You can buy them in IKEA, and a few people have them. I think people who have been to Scandinavia have come back and gone, yeah, I need one of these. These are really sensible. But there are many people in the UK who cut their cheese with a knife like an animal. If animals were to use knives.
Yeah, because thin slices of cheese, once you have had that, it's hard to go back.
It is hard to go back. And in fairness, I do know when I was a kid, we had a family friend who cut himself really badly in the hand by cutting cheese with a knife. So I think actually you're probably safer using a cheese slicer. Except apparently all our colleagues.
In Denmark, they have a slightly... other patent.
Is that the thing with the goes around?
Yeah.
The cheese wire.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have those in the UK as well, but they're really rare. I think it's a bit old school.
Yeah, and they are... Often you get weird cheeses.
In the UK or in Denmark? Or?
Well, because they don't cut it like always straight through, so you got these weird shapes and...
Oh, right. And then it kind of, you get this path dependence thing where it just becomes weirder and weirder. And
That happens with the cheese slicers as well.
Yes.
Because there's a proper technique and there's a wrong technique. And for some reason, people tend to use the wrong technique.
What is the wrong technique?
The underhand.
Where you put it on your palm of your hand and you bring it towards you. Isn't that just a recipe for like cutting open your wrists with
this thing? No, not like that. Okay. So you grab the cheese slicer from
I wish you could see under. This, people. Yeah. But yeah.
Like you would do when you was about to stab someone, right? I guess we have to add pictures to...
This is a video. How to slice cheese properly.
Yeah, this is a video.
Okay, right, we're doing
cheese
this.
Cheese slice challenge. Okay. So, then you got this huge pressure on the middle of the cheese. So you got this cheese half pipe, sort of...
Episode title.
Yeah. So, but if you do the overhanded grab and firmly but lightly drags cheese slicer on the top of the cheese back, you will get a leveled straight cheese all the way down.
I've recently learned that if the cheese is too warm, it can start warping when you drag.
Yeah. Well, also depends on your cheese slicer.
Maybe it's not sharp enough. Can you get sharpeners for these things, or do you just have to buy a new one?
I think you can sharpen them.
I don't know how. We've got a sharpener, but it's for knives.
There's a difference between sharpening and the other thing. When you use a knife steel, it isn't sharpening. It's something else.
Wetting? No. Or do you wet? You wet the stone.
You wet the stone.
You have a wet stone.
We have to investigate this.
Okay. More research needed.
I don't think we have a cheese slicer based påskekrim yet.
That's going to be ugly. The victim is not going to look good.
Like the Norwegian version of Fargo, I guess.
Yeah. Except I'm imagining the results of that crime ending up in some breakfast buffet.
Yeah. Didn't Roald Dahl write a story like that?
If he didn't, he should have.
The one where the cop ate the evidence, i.e. the husband.
I don't remember this.
In a steak.
I did not read this book.
It is a short story.
Either.
I made a segue to the Polska Krim.
Sorry, and I just let it drop.
Yeah.
I was fascinated by the idea that, sorry, you got into this whole cannibalism thing and now, okay, right. Focus, Chris, focus. Okay, segue. Well, Knut Googles. Polska Krim has a backstory. And the short version of this is that there was a crime story called Bergen Train Looted in the Night. And this was written by Nordahl Grieg and Nils Lie. And the story was published and people rushed out to buy it. And that sort of kicked off the whole, this was happening Easter 1923, and that kicked off the whole idea of having a sort of Polska Krim, Easter crime thing, apparently. It says here, link in the show notes.
Yeah, so the story I talked about was Lamb to the Slaughter.
Is it for kids?
Depends. I think I heard this story as a kid. And reading from Wikipedia, which is always right. Lamb to the Slaughter demonstrates Dahl's fascination with horror with elements of black comedy, which is seen both in his adult fiction and his stories for children. The story was supposedly suggested to Dahl by his friend Ian Fleming.
Ian. Hey.
They were friends? Why don't you have someone murder their husband with a frozen leg of mutton, which he then serves to the detectives who come to investigate the murder? So I don't think it was a husband, but it was the means by...
Yeah,
which she
they ate
him.
The evidence. Yeah. But this is interesting because when you first started talking about this, it sounded like they'd eaten the victim.
Yeah, because that was what I remembered. But
okay.
Perhaps there's another version where that happens.
So many questions about the shaved meat and the... Yeah, anyway.
There had to be a lot of lotion on his skin, though. Our colleague found a dead bird in his ventilation thingy yesterday.
That was deeply disturbing. Deeply. It came with photographs. This is...
So we posted images and then radio silence.
Right. Well, there was some brief live slacking and then it all went dark.
Well, images of that as well, I guess.
This episode has become very macabre, I notice.
Yeah, this is the filler episode.
Another one?
This is episode where we derail from the plot line. And
this describes thus far all episodes.
Yeah.
Wait, there's a plot?
There's a plot.
Okay.
And, yeah.
In continued follow-up, this is not follow-up at all, this is just something I was listening to in the week. There was an Easter episode of Sprocktigen, which is a really fun language nerding podcast that goes out here, and they discuss so there's this concept of unparliamentary, uparlamentarisk, which gets a lot of discussion because there is a code of conduct if you are in parliament, and you're not supposed to insult people or be rude to them or use particular terms that would be I guess derogatory or in themselves rude. And it made me laugh because they were talking, there's always debate about whether something has been unparliamentary. And when people are debating, sometimes the discussion will stop. And there's this kind of, excuse me, but I think you'll find that was unparliamentary. And the discussion in this podcast made me laugh because they had someone in to comment on the story. And they said, well, you know, it's important to talk about this stuff, and it's important to talk about, I guess, freedom of expression in Parliament, but also, obviously, we don't want things to be like in England, where people are just booing each other, which made me laugh aloud in the street, because the perception that that's how it goes down in the UK, which is not wrong, by the way, although I think Australia maybe has the edge on the British Parliament, but... it was kind of interesting, like that. You know, obviously we're civilized people. We don't want to behave like the animals in England. That really made me laugh.
Yeah. They have to be pretty formal when they're speaking to the parliament. You have these politicians who have made an art of being formal whilst being funny and. Comedies sort of phenomenal stuff.
Insults.
Yeah. Just subtle insults
yeah.
covered in formal language. And I guess that you will have that in Britain as well, I guess. But
not perhaps to the extent here. They talk a little bit about that in this yeah. episode. And that people sort of talk their way around these formal requirements. I mean, people do in the UK Parliament, they do start, you know, I think if they're going to address Parliament, they start with Mr. Speaker or whatever, which is to kind of address the person who's sort of managing the whole show. And they refer to each other as, you know, the Right Honourable Gentleman and things like this. And, you know, there's kind of all these terms of art that I guess are used to dress up what sometimes is basically just a pissing contest. But I'm not sure how much art there is. Sometimes there is. Sometimes there's a lot of kind of arch comedy talking around a subject, but I don't know. But like, is the perception here, like, have you seen the British Parliament on TV or anything with people kind of booing each other?
Hey, that's the thing. Aye.
There's voting. Well, there's yeah. kind of ayes, and you know, there's like yeah. kind of assent to things, but there's also if someone has begun something that is particularly unpopular, people on the other benches from the other parties might just boo them. There might just be lots of people shouting, boo! Does that happen here?
That doesn't happen here.
Okay. What do people do if they want to protest what is being said right there?
We don't vote for the suggestion.
It's quietly and passively and just kind of, they get you with the legislation rather than the... Yeah.
They lean back with their arms crossed.
Mm, yes.
Or look down at their phones.
Or play Pokemon.
Links in the show notes.
Yeah.
Well, it's officially spring now.
It is. I know that because I had my first beer outdoors. It was a bit of a technicality. We were in one of those kind of courtyards.
Yeah, the get around the smoking law.
Yeah.
Not quite inside, but not quite outside.
Right. It was one yeah. of those. And then it hailed on us. It was a beautiful spring evening, and then weather came.
Did the utepils taste better outside than inside?
Tasted colder. It was different. I mean, I've drunk beer outdoors in the UK. It was almost certainly warmer. We're not as aggressive usually about chilling our beer. It depends. Increasingly, it's just come from the fridge in a bottle. So, yeah, of course, that's cold.
When we had the company trip to London last year, we drank beer at the sidewalk.
Yeah, on the pavement, we would say in the UK.
Yeah.
Yeah. This isn't a thing you can do here?
No.
Say more.
Because you aren't allowed to take the alcohol outside of the premises. And I don't think you technically are allowed to do that in, or perhaps there's a perimeter or something.
Right. There is a line. So when you drink outside a pub in the UK, there's usually kind of an agreed area where you can do that and you can't. For example, if it's a narrow street with not a lot of traffic, sometimes people would prefer perhaps to go across the street, particularly if they want to smoke or whatever. And there's often signs across the street saying you can't stand here and drink your beer, you have to go back over the road. Or, you know, someone will come out and say you can't stand there, you need to come back over here. So they're kind of very clearly, not clearly, but very demarcated areas where you would be able to stand and not stand. But in London, where space is a problem in pubs and where the weather is often really nice in the summer, everyone stands outside, and it's not uncommon that there are five times more people standing outside in the street than there are inside the pub when the weather is nice. But do people not do that here? People sit sometimes outside pubs here, like there are chairs, right, with blankets and stuff.
Yeah, I guess. So we have these outside areas where people are allowed to sit and have their beer. But you couldn't take the beer out of that area and right. into sort of public space.
And they're often like, there's like a rope line or something, yeah. right, that kind of hems you in. And you have that in the UK too, particularly for outdoor seating, but sometimes also for standing. Yeah. So this makes me wonder about kind of drinking in the street rules here as well, because 17th of May, Norwegian National Day, people drink, right? How is that policed? Is it policed?
Yes, yeah, so you generally you aren't allowed to enjoy alcohol in public.
There must be no enjoyment.
No enjoyment.
Okay.
Or
can you drink it without enjoying it?
No.
Okay, just checking.
And what people do, especially in parks in the summer.
Yeah.
And it's kind of.
It goes under the radar a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. People do that in the UK as well.
And there is this discussion about being more lax on those rules.
Why?
Because people want to drink beer in the park.
So is there a kind sense that the police or whoever would enforce this should just sort of ignore it? Or okay.
Yeah. On 17 May, this is very much a children's day.
Okay.
For most of the day. So it's not that much alcohol consumption during the day, but perhaps in the evening.
That hadn't been my impression from sort of video and general cultural things.
You talk about Zurus?
No, that's. But let's talk about that because that's already started.
There's also this thing about this breakfast of 17th
yeah.
of May, which is a more elaborate
right.
thing.
Where I saw you that also in Stom.
Champagne.
So. Yeah.
And if it is sunny outside, grown-ups would tend to sit and have an utepils.
Mm. We can deal with this more in May.
Yeah.
In Norwegian, maybe. Rus.
You want to talk about Rus? Okay.
It came up.
Yeah.
I'm starting to see people in tracksuits, in kind of, I don't know, what would you call the, what they wear?
This is my word of the week.
Oh, well, let's jump in. Do it.
Russedrakt.
Right. A Russ uniform, outfit, suit, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like Romdrakt. Yeah. Okay.
I'm not sure, can Russ be translated?
I have no idea what its roots are. Is there an intoxication kind of element in the word?
You would believe that, but no, not really.
We should take a step back.
Yeah.
What is Rus?
That's the state you go into when you are finishing high school.
But what actually happens?
Rus never tells. well,
we'll talk about your experience in a minute.
So this is a thing that happens in the final spring semester of high school. And the claim is it is a celebration that you have endured that many years of school. And, well, it is elaborate partying, actually.
Yeah, but
outfits.
To qualify this isn't a party. This is a party that goes on for like a month.
Yeah.
Continuously.
Yeah.
And
when you have your final exams and stuff like that.
And this is happening, it kind of leads up to the 17th of May, right?
Yeah.
But this is happening continuously and people are hiring buses. So like watching Scum at the moment, this is like a huge preoccupation for all of the students there is like, we need to get a bus, a party bus, and it's going to cost a lot of money and we got to get one and we got to drive it around and have a good time and then meet up with other party buses at kind of designated locations. And this has started in reality, not just in Scum. And there was a story in the paper the other day about kind of a brawl between young people who were out for this and the police in Bergen. But it's just, the scale of this is extraordinary. Like, I don't know what happens in the UK now, not being a young person leaving high school anymore, but the scale of this staggers me. And the fact that this is so big a part of culture that people who are like 17, 18 we just kind of spend a month being drunk publicly and incurring a lot of money. I'm staggered.
Yeah, and it has become more elaborate for the, I guess, last 10, 15 years, where it has become business, so there are many commercial things going on, like selling these, I think, overalls.
Yeah, what is it with that? That's a great word for this. That's exactly what it is.
And buses, and also we had this thing that the buses tend to have their own sort of party song.
Just one.
Yeah, they license a party song from some techno artist or something with usually very crude lyrics.
And what, do they just like play it continuously?
Yeah.
It's important to have a sound system in the bus, right? Like, does it send out the music from the bus or is it just internal?
You will...
I will find out.
Yeah.
Okay.
But before, when I was a Rus, there were some of these party buses as well, especially in Oslo. But usually you buy an old Volkswagen or something, this old van, and you paint it red, and you write some stuff on it. And then you drive in around and drink beer inside.
Well, someone else preferably drives it around, right? Like, you need a designated driver.
Yeah, you need that.
Yeah. So did you do this?
No, I...
At all?
Not really. I was at a couple of things, but I was not good to this.
You didn't spend a month basically being drunk?
No.
I'm staggered at the tolerance that Norwegian society seems to have for a bunch of people, many of whom are probably not of legal drinking age, to just spend a month drunk. It's, I can't imagine an equivalent in the UK.
I think there would be, this is the year that they turn 19, I think.
So they're supposed to be of legal drinking age. But people graduate high school at age sort of 18, 19 here.
Yeah.
That's a year older than in the UK.
Yeah, so...
You can be 16 and go to university in Scotland, but that's a whole other thing. That's exceptional. More ordinarily, you would be 17 or 18.
But I guess we will come back to this.
I feel
so. In the next couple of episodes. But you posted the link to... I guess this is this marks the start of the Russifiering, and it got a bit out of hand.
Just a bit.
There were police violence. That doesn't happen a lot in Norway.
Okay, that's good to hear.
Stupid teenagers.
We skipped right over the whiskey bit.
Yeah.
I keep wondering, when I come to the West Coast, why no one is making whiskey here? Because the soil is really Scottish, it's really peaty. The water is really like Scottish water. It would be probably really easy to do if you knew how to make whiskey in Norway. But I see you put a link in.
Yeah, because I found that there are indeed Norwegian whiskies being made. Not in that area, but but yeah. I'm not sure. Perhaps they are occupied with brewing beer.
Yeah.
But also, you have... I don't have anything to compare it to, but I would guess strict laws about burning spirits. So you aren't allowed to burn anything that will have a larger alcohol degree than 22%. And that's a bit low for whiskey.
Right.
So you have to get a permission and so on.
Because it's a fire hazard, or I'm missing something here?
Burning? To make spirits, right? You have to...
Distill. Well, you have to...
Distill, yeah.
Right.
In Norwegian, it's called brenne.
Oh, gotcha. Like, right. Yeah, I'm with you now. Yeah.
yeah, so... I believe it's a bit of an elaborate process to get that permit.
Okay. Interesting.
How is that in
I've never personally applied for a distillation license in the UK, so
it isn't common sort of knowledge.
I don't know. It is not, actually. I don't know what the thing is. When I was talking about this,
Are you allowed to have a distill apparatus at your home?
That's a great question. I don't know. I have to find out.
Because this is a thing in Norway.
Because to stop people from making their own spirits unlicensed, I guess.
Yeah.
I would be surprised if it wasn't quite similar in the UK, but I don't know. I've never tried.
This is what they in the States would call moonshine.
Right, absolutely.
And that was very much a thing where I grew up.
Really?
Yeah.
Tell us everything.
I think you just distill sugar water or something.
Not like potatoes or...
No. And
this isn't Russia.
And you will get this very bad vodka-ish stuff that you would mix with soda or something.
Did you drink this?
No, I didn't. I began drinking pretty late. That is like 17.
10:30 p.m. Right.
But I had friends that started at 14 and so on.
Yeah, I wasn't with those people either. I was with the late drinkers. Very late.
My first drinking experience was in Denmark, actually. At the Roskilde Festival.
Oh, nice. That seems like a good place to do that.
Yeah, it was.
Who was playing?
It was a good year. We had Björk, Queens of Stone Age, Metallica, Sigur Rós, Interpol, Exploding Plastics, Iron Maiden. I didn't watch that though, but because I was too cool.
This is like 2002 or something? I'm doing the math.
2003, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a good.
It's a good lineup. Year. Yeah. The Metallica concert were pretty rad. But Björk had more pyrotechnics.
I'm not surprised.
Right. Random questions. Swords. Yeah.
Ellis wondered if PhDs in Norway get awarded swords, as apparently they are in Finland.
No.
Oh. That's too bad.
But the defense, it is.
It's not physical defense of a thesis.
It can be, but it...
Do you get to choose, like, which martial art or, like, which weapon or swinging this big thing with spikes on it in the hope that the external examiner will stay far enough away?
I think perhaps I would prefer that. But the deans and the main...
examiner?
Yeah, they have to wear robes, and there's a procession. And
oh, actually, during the thesis defense, this
yeah.
is... Oh, because it's public here, right?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, yeah, it's private in the UK. And it can take, like, all day here as well, right? Ish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It takes a couple of hours.
Oh, a couple of hours and all day are very different. Or mine was, like,
half
3.
Half a day, perhaps.
Mine was 3 hours, but that's long.
That would be normal, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it spans 2 days because first you have to have this directly translated. It would be trial lecture.
Right.
So you have to hold typically an introductory lecture in something. The first day and the second day you would have your defense.
I'm told that the examiners can, on the basis of that introductory lecture, decide to fail you. Which seems a bit harsh.
It's a theoretical possibility, but it never happens.
Okay.
Yeah. Also because most of the PhD have some experience with teaching already.
Right.
That wasn't necessarily the case before.
Hmm.
Yeah. And there's a party afterwards, of course.
Of course.
But it's more of like a formal party as well. So you would have your supervisors and your opponents there and there would be speeches and,
wow.
and all that.
That's a big deal. I think I just went out for dinner with my parents after mine. Ellis also asked whether they wear white ties at funerals in Norway. I don't know why he asked this.
And no, we don't.
Okay. Okay, short, sweet.
Confession time.
Wow.
Oh, I have sinned.
Well, this is your area of expertise, so do you want to run this section of the show? Because
I don't know. Now, when I'm doing the confession, somebody has to be the confessionaire.
Confessor? No. Yeah. Okay, I will hear your confession. I'm not really qualified.
Manager of confessions.
Yeah. Wrangler. Confession wrangler. Give me what you got.
You made me aware after we had recorded the episode.
What, you wanted me to just butt in the middle and tell you right there?
That I used the term token, as in our token Scottish person. Kind of wrongly, or perhaps just wrongly, or wrong.
It wasn't wholly wrong.
It was like almost, but no cigar kind of thing, I guess. But
Yeah,
I sincerely apologize. What was the wrongness? So I meant like as the chosen typical example of a person with certain characteristics.
Right.
That was a very difficult way to explain it.
But it worked.
But token means something, a bit something else.
Yeah, like when you describe someone as, for example, I've worked in technology a lot the last few years, and I was often the token woman. And that means that I'm kind of included for completeness, but not because... And that's actually not what happened at all. But I'm trying to think of an example where someone is included as the token woman or the token black person or the token whatever, which is like, well, we know we need some diversity here, so let's get someone. Or sometimes it can just be used to refer to the only person, like, well, they were represented, but by one person, not in any way meaningfully represented. So when we talk about me on the show as being the token Scot, it kind of works, but it sort of means like there's one of them. And so technically we have one. But it's not necessarily. So I don't know. Like, I'm sure there are people listening who are going, yeah, but it's not wrong to describe you as the token Scot on the show, but it's often used where there's a larger group of people and there's only one person representing a particular set of demographics, I guess, or experience.
So I will obviously never use this word again.
I'm so sorry.
What kind of Scot are you then on this show?
I'm a very, it's a technicality kind of Scot, right?
No. Or a technical Scot?
Well, the fact that I'm Scottish is a technicality because neither of my parents are Scottish, but I grew up there. I lived there for many, many, many years. I self-identify as being from there. So.
And the show needs you to be.
And the show needs me to be Scottish, or at the very least British, right? I guess I am a representative of Scotland on the show. I don't know how else to describe it. I am the Scottish half of the show, if you like. Yeah, I got nothing. But I would not have used the word token. But neither did I want it to turn into like a public beating. That wasn't my intention either.
As we just mentioned, we Norwegians are used to having a public defense about our academic qualifications.
Okay.
And,
Well, let's take this outside into the street then, and I can publicly beat you for the humiliation of, the fact that, you misuse the word token. How dare you misuse a word in your second language? I mean, how dare you?
I will borrow the sword of my Finnish friends.
Excellent.
So, yeah.
Well, now I'm afraid. My confession time. Since we're doing confessions. Well, you were at least qualified to hear this, I feel, as a scholar of religion. Is there anything particular I should do as part of this confession? Is confession a thing that people do here? Strikes me as a very kind of Catholic thing. And
we have Catholics.
More than two?
Yeah. There's quite a... Well, everything is relative, but there's a large congregation in Bergen, actually. We have lots of Polish immigrants and so on.
Right. My confession. Sorry, that was not me trying to get out of confessing. My confession is that I sang flat in the first verse when I was singing last time before. It's mortifying to listen to that. It evens out, like I get myself together, but in the first I was just very, very kind of nervous. And for whatever reason, it made me sing flat. And I hear back and I'm like, oh. And it's not very, very flat, but it's enough to notice. It's painful.
You had the chance to be the Susan Boyle of this podcast.
I think I kind of I got it together later on, but I don't know why I started flat. That was just weird. It's horrible.
I have absolutely no authority here, because I think you managed way better than I did.
Well, that's kind of you to say, but
this can actually be we can go back and measure.
Oh, how flat people are singing. It's true. We can science the shit out of this.
Yeah. No, I suppose now I should give you some ways to resolve that sin.
Yes, what should I do?
And I guess you have to listen to the entirety of Les Misérables.
That's harsh. Isn't there something else? Is there no other way that I could write this wrong? Why? Why would you say that?
Because it shouldn't be pleasant. I thought you liked that. But I know that you don't.
Well, I haven't listened to it all.
Yeah, and also we haven't done our homework.
No, we haven't. This is a joint confession.
Yeah.
We're not doing folklore this week.
Obviously.
Sorry.
What a great episode that will be.
I hope so. Yeah, build it up, why don't you? What if it's not? Life and work got in the way a bit much this week, so we're going to postpone that and do our homework. Sorry.
So sorry.
So sorry.
But we did read that thing.
About legibility?
No.
Or the other thing?
The other thing.
This came from you.
Yeah.
So you start.
Well, I mentioned her before as this author, feminist, Finnish person.
Finally, we come to a noun.
And she has lived in Norway for quite a while and worked here as an, wait for it, sociologist. Somehow she has become this commentator on Norwegian culture and society. And her ethos tend to be that you are not so great as you think you are. In Finland, however.
Oh, really?
We have figured it out. Yeah.
Okay.
Reading from the Twitter reception of her stuff, people don't tend to express agreement or... They tend to not like her. But at the same time, I think we are fascinated or we find it intriguing.
Well, you've said before that you like the external perspective and acknowledgement that Norway exists, right? So it's kind of... This is interesting. So she's quite dismissive of Norway / Norwegians.
Yeah.
Because Finland is quote-unquote better, I guess.
What's
she saying in this piece?
Yeah, so I linked to a piece, and the title is Norwegians, a group of anarchists, or a posse of anarchists would be perhaps the better.
Gang?
A gang isn't
Yeah, it's
great,
got connotations now, yeah. A bunch of anarchists,
yeah,
there you go.
And the excerpt is, it is a paradox that the people... in a country where they always talk about the collective and the fellowship.
It doesn't. I'm struggling. Fellowship, but is a poor collectivist something something.
Mm. Community, perhaps.
Yeah, but, not really, but yeah.
there we lost it. So in a country where people are occupied with the collective and let's find a solution together and dugnad and so on, they don't respect the rules. They have the rules, but they don't respect them.
Is this your perception too?
And here's the thing. So it's like she got a point. Sure. I don't think your experiences are not valid and so on. But I'm not...
You think Norwegians are more rules-based than not and more conformist than not?
Yeah.
But
I see her point.
Like, but, relative to Sweden, I'd say she's got a point.
I
think conformity and kind of that sort of sense of shared conformity and adherence to things seems to be stronger in Sweden than here. Norway's a little bit rebellious in that way, maybe.
Let's not confuse conformity and obeying rules.
Tell me how those two things are different. Conformity is like social rules as opposed to obeying rules, which is kind of formal rules.
Because she mostly talks about formal rules there. Mm. And I think the trouble is that the trouble comes with comparison. A bit. I don't really know because I don't have a basis for real comparison here. But I suspect that this boils down also to personality. Because there are quite a lot of people in Norway that are annoyed when other people break the rules. For example, in queuing or...
Ah, so you have that too here. It's a very British preoccupation to be annoyed when someone has broken kind of queue etiquette.
And there isn't so much a culture for calling these people out, and I don't perhaps think there are in Britain as well, but perhaps
no in the UK if someone cuts in line you would just tut and be really angry, but almost certainly not say anything. If you're particularly assertive, you might say, "Excuse me, there's a queue."
So
what kind of rules is she talking about?
So being a Finnish person, she is the first thing is the shower situation after or before you go into the swimming pool.
Right, this needs unpacking a bit for a British audience, certainly.
Yeah. There's a thing called swimming pools.
Okay, we have
and
those.
And bathing.
Okay, we have those, but a big, big difference here.
Also showers.
A big difference here. Is that you're expected often, I found this in Denmark, I haven't been to very many public swimming pools in Norway actually, but certainly in Denmark you're expected to shower naked before you get in the pool, to be properly clean before you get in the pool. In the UK you put on your swimming clothes and then you shower, and sometimes people don't even bother with that. The pool that I was in Copenhagen, they were like, we hardly use any chlorine. It's especially important that you shower naked and like that you are very, very clean before you even put on your bathing suit. And I assume that's the same here. There's some nodding, which in podcast land is silent.
it is the same here. And we were taught that in school as well.
Right.
That's
not a feature of British education.
And there has been this controversy of the gymnastics trainer checking up if the kids are and so on.
Yeah.
And of course, in Finland, everybody obeys the rule of nakedness.
Aren't people like naked 50% of the time in Finland?
Yeah. And
sorry, Finnish listener.
Yeah. And but she ascribes this to anarchism. But I'm not sure if that's the right diagnosis for this thing.
What would you say is?
Shyness.
Okay.
And perhaps conformity, somewhat, or insecureness or something.
Okay. So like a lack of comfort with being naked. We talked about this a bit before when I talked about going to the spa, but it seems like by British standards, Norwegians are very unbothered by nakedness in that kind of context. Now I'm wondering if people ever protest naked on bicycles here. You see it sometimes in the UK and quite a lot in Barcelona, for example.
People generally don't protest in that way.
Okay.
I was surprised how many showed up for the March of Science, March for Science in April thing.
That wasn't naked.
No.
Naked Science is, maybe Naked Science Week is in the summer sometime. That would be kind. Yeah, yeah.
Isn't that what happens in at conferences?
What happens at the conference stays at the conference.
So, yeah. And so there were this shower thing.
Mm. So she was saying that like people basically don't... there are some people who refuse to shower naked or just don't shower naked anyway. That this expresses a lack of conformity. But I wonder how many people do that. Like, have you seen people kind of conspicuously not doing this? Or I don't know whether you go to public swimming pools at all. But
I don't.
Okay.
So.
Short conversation. That's fine. Me neither, but.
And I wouldn't sit down to take sort of the numbers. That would be weird.
It would be weird to go in there with a clipboard and stuff. I'll give you that and just sit there. Yeah, yeah. Don't be creepy.
So, and the other examples she mentions is, for example, she were hired as a Toastmaster for some 60-year celebration party, and being a Finn, of course, she had this schedule planned out.
Is that a thing that Finns are known for, is to schedule this kind of thing?
Yeah, they are pretty systematic.
Okay. That's quite a broad brush stroke there, but okay.
Well, she asked for it. No. But yeah, and somebody had the audacity to raise up and hold a speech without notifying her beforehand.
Right.
How could he?
How dare they? Right. Well, I got to take the third party perspective here and say that when we had the Julebord, there was a lot of speechifying, and it was done on a schedule, a very tight schedule, actually, to get everyone in and to make all these speeches. And I'm not accustomed to being in a country where people, like, make a bunch of formal speeches. The only time that really happens is at weddings in the UK, I think, that there is kind of a schedule, and this person will talk at this time for roughly this long and blah, blah, blah. So I'm a bit taken aback by this whole concept of having many organized timed speeches at things generally, especially kind of dinners and stuff and parties. You all look pretty organized to me, is what I'm saying. And not very anarchistic.
But the especially the uncle that have to say something during a more formal gathering or celebration.
You mean someone who hasn't been invited to speak but just sort of feels the need to contribute?
That's a thing. You should expect that.
Okay.
So this one, that's her own fault. She should calculate that this will happen.
Right.
It's unavoidable. And she kind of makes this about her. He broke her schedule.
Right.
It is nothing about perhaps this...
this person who was 60 or whatever.
Yeah. Perhaps he or she appreciated that speech.
Maybe.
And also, I think, again, it can be due to insecurity. Because it may be the case that this person all the time wanted to say something but didn't dare to, right? And hence didn't announce that he would make an indeed make a speech.
Mm.
But after a couple of drinks,
was moved. The spirit was moved to yeah.
That's a typical dynamic.
Is that someone after a couple of drinks?
Yeah.
Well, this is a thing we've talked about before, right? The kind of the loss of inhibition after alcohol in Norway, and that people go from being apparently reserved, though I don't see it, to less reserved. I mean, you know, I'm an introvert. I can relate to that.
It's human.
Yeah. Oh, God, I hate labeling myself an introvert, but it seems unavoidable sometimes.
She ascribes this to the patriot. Patriot. Please help me. I'm so feminist, I can't even...
The patriarchy?
Yeah.
Or patriarchal, or...
Which perhaps it may be a point that the... dismiss the rules made by the Finnish lady, but
I'm not sure I'm really buying that either.
And she also complains about students that are complaining instead of working, and there I can give her a point. Again, I'm not sure about the comparison, but Norwegian students could indeed do a bit more effort, at least in some places.
Like what?
There's a different cultures of studying. If you go to business school, for example, you would be down in the books pretty much all day.
Whereas?
If you go to the humanities, for example...
Just an all-day party.
Or just an all-day sitting, drinking coffee and talk about stuff.
Okay.
Which also is it's a way of studying human condition, I guess. But being a tutor and having taught many university courses, I could see a bit more effort and a bit less... self-righteous complaining.
Hmm. I'm trying to think about that from my experience of university teaching. There's very little complaining. Very, very little complaining. And I think that reflects the student body that we had, which was generally not particularly entitled. I could imagine a lot more complaining at other institutions than the one that I worked at, where people were working sometimes... often part-time and sometimes full-time jobs in addition to studying, and we're just trying to get through it. Very little complaining.
And she ascribes this mentality to back in the days when we were under the Danish rule.
It's just like a kind of knee-jerk against occupation, not occupation, but...
So that we... establish this culture of opposing rules from the outside. And it might be tempting, and I don't think she is that serious about it, but it doesn't hold water. The society in Norway during, for example, the 50s, as any Western society, were pretty compliant. So...
Really, probably what she's talking about are trends that are not really about Norway.
Yeah,
if they are trends.
And it's complex, right? It's complex.
Is complex, and we can't read all the layers.
And and it's about the lack, perhaps, of a stratified mentality, or because we aren't very authoritarian, I guess.
Norway.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get the impression authoritarianism is not really a thing here. Like, people kind of respect and understand the need for authority, but authority seems rarely overused.
Yeah. And but I think anarchism is not the right term here, because we are very much for governance.
Mm.
you wouldn't dare to take away the welfare system and kind of the structures that these kind of structures and so on and the institutions, but it's
is it individualism?
I think it's a touch of individualism, which has come with the riches,
the you money. Think?
Yeah,
you don't think it's I don't see it as necessarily a legacy of Norway's kind of wealth. I see it maybe as an influence of kind of Western American type stuff, which admittedly it's really hard to separate that out from the wealth thing, but it's more about, or maybe you can't separate them.
I don't think so, because the wealth, it makes it possible for you to buy yourself out of stuff.
Yeah. Okay, I get
people, instead of meeting up for the dugnad, they are paying their way out of it, right?
Right.
So it's kind of that in a sense.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think about this from a kind of capitalist / materialist point of view, where if you have more wealth, you can buy the non kind of standard option, I guess.
Also, it is perhaps also a product of us not being that many people.
Because
there's less of a need for conformity, or sort of the consequences of you not following these rules are lesser because there are lesser people. There's
less society to break down.
Yeah.
I don't know, like, what, you just destroyed the illusion of all these people who are imagining Norway as this very sort of tight collective of people all huddled together for warmth in the frozen north. There is no room for a kind
as
of...
As I mentioned last time, we have a history of getting as far as away from our neighbours as possible.
Highly dispersed. Yeah. While simultaneously huddling together at a kind of sociological level. Yeah. But like, give me plenty of room. Okay, interesting.
But, and the last point she has is... And here also she touches on something. Again, I'm not sure about the comparison. I think there are countries that are have this as well. But the fact that you can't decide on anything without having dozens of hearings beforehand.
For example?
So if you as a politician want to do something, want to build a road or anything... You have to check with many instances beforehand.
Right. There has to be a lot of consultation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that unusual? Same is true in the UK, I think.
Yeah.
Is that not just like civilized?
I think it comes from a civilized place, but she has a point. If you do that too extensively, you will end up not... managing to do anything.
Because it becomes too bureaucratic.
Yeah.
Do you think Norway is too bureaucratic? Again, I'm pointing at Sweden as a point of comparison, which is widely regarded, I think, to be very bureaucratic.
I don't think it's
bureaucracy.
Yeah, but I think it's more that people don't want to decide on something because then they are perhaps... becoming accountable for that decision.
So it's better to remain woolly.
Yeah.
Mm.
And if you are going to decide something, at least you have heard all the people beforehand. So you don't get the, I wasn't heard afterwards.
Right.
So, yeah.
Hmm.
I saw this at the university as well. We will not decide on this because then we perhaps will make a precedence. Because it always has to be fair.
Right, so inaction is preferable to action that might be perceived as unfair.
Exactly.
Oh, kill me. Wow, okay. Use the word kardemommeloven, the cardamom law.
Yeah.
What's that about?
This is a thing from the previous cultural pick of the week, Kardemommebyen, the musical.
Right.
And the police chief there, he has this thing called the Kardamome Law. And it's... du ska inte plaga andra. Du ska vara grej och snäll. Och för övrigt kan du göra som du vill.
Right.
Can you translate?
Yeah, don't bother other people. If you don't kind of disturb or do things that are disadvantageous to other people, then you can basically do what you want.
Yeah.
So it's kind of libertarian. Yeah. Are you laughing because I was struggling with a word?
Yeah, and because I was kind of a clever dick on Twitter about that. But you tried to be a clever dick first. So,
I got what I deserved. It's fine.
But it could perhaps also be anarchist. Because it is an anarchist dictum. The trouble is it comes from a police officer. So there's some...
right, there's something weird going on there. Yeah.
But...
And how does that apply in Norway? Is it generally like, don't do things that are detrimental to other people, but as long as you kind of stay within reasonable lines, you can do what you want? Or...
I want to say yes, but I don't think I can.
Why?
Because I don't think it... Everybody knows this rule, but I don't think it's very salient in everyday life.
So how does it actually play out? People are more conformist than that?
Yeah. When I thought about this piece by Sanna Samora Saruma. I never pronounced it aloud before, but I can ascribe most of these things to insecurity.
Hers or
no,
other people?
She's not insecure at all, but to
maybe she is, and maybe that's her problem.
Yeah, I guess you could flip that around. Yeah, so no, the Norwegian insecurity.
Okay.
Which is a branch of conformism, I guess.
Yeah.
Or leads to one.
Would you bracket Norwegian insecurity? Would you include in that the fear / suspicion that no one is paying attention to Norway? And that Norway is this tiny country that no one thinks about?
No, because it's more an internal thing.
Like at a personal level?
Yeah,
or the state
between
level.
Norwegians.
Mm. Intra-Norwegianal.
Insecurity, yeah.
Right.
There we have it.
Title. So we've done your cultural... No, we've done your word of the week, which is Russ.
Russdress.
Russ. What was the second part of that?
Russdress.
Oh, Russdress. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Which is the... You said drakt before.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Which is it?
Russedrakt.
Okay, so now we're... Like, because russedress would be a suit, right? Whereas russedrakt is more sort of uniform or outfit or overalls, you said, which is a good word.
No, it is russedress.
Yeah?
But yeah, that's kind of the overalls.
Yeah, okay. Like, normally the dress would be like a suit, right?
Yeah.
Like something smart. And this is sports casual.
Yeah.
It's so weird. We'll put pictures in. It's amazing. Cultural picks.
Yeah. My cultural pick of the week has to do with reindeer. And what happens every year is that the reindeer are taken from the mountains, the vidda, and to the coastline.
The plain.
Yeah, kind the of. Plain from the plain to the coast. It's this whole ordeal.
For the reindeer?
Yeah, and for the people that have to move them.
So they actually move, they don't move themselves? It's not a kind of unplanned migration?
Well, it's
or...
a kind of a collaboration, I guess, but yeah, they, nice have to be prompted. They have to be prompted to move. So we have this tradition of making slow TV.
Right.
We have the Bergensbana,
right.
And the Hurtigruta. Now we have reindeer moving.
This is awesome.
Minute for minute. So you can go in and check up on the live stream of the reindeer.
Is it drone camera footage? Like,
I haven't seen
they...
any, because I will link to a piece about the technical setup, which is pretty interesting.
I bet.
It's it is a technical challenge to do this. And you can use Google Translate. It just got better. They have put proper machine learning behind it. So
you can actually translate this page with minimal drama.
Yeah. I haven't tested it, but yeah.
Okay.
And you can read more about the background for the project.
Awesome.
And you can go in and, at least for now, watch either the recording or the live stream of the reindeer moving.
I love the idea of live streaming reindeer because they are in themselves kind of streaming. So it's like meta streaming. It's very cool. My cultural pick of the week. I went to a concert. I went to a rap concert, I guess. I hate calling it rap because it makes me sound like I'm 60. Young people's music. Friday morning, I woke up, I drank some coffee, I read the paper, and there was a review of Carpe Diem, who are an Oslo duo, who are a kind of rap, hip-hop, kind of slightly pop artists, and it was a great review. They were like, I want to give this 7. So here, we haven't talked about rating systems, but just as a throwaway, things get rated on a 6-point scale here, 1 to 6.
Yeah, a dice.
Right, and it's the metaphor is a die, like plural dice, to be anal about that for a minute. And this is not how we do it downtown in the UK. This is like, traditionally it's 5 stars, or you could do it out of 10, but never 6. So it's kind of interesting in itself. But the reviewer was like, this was a great, great gig. So good. I wanted to give it a 7. It was that good. And so I was reading this review going, oh, damn, I would have really enjoyed that. That sounds like a great gig. 5 hours later, my boss is in Slack saying, I have 2 tickets to Carpe Diem. Does anyone want? Me. Yes, please. I want to go. So I get a ticket, which is great. And it's rarely in life that one's wishes are fulfilled that explicitly or quickly. So that was really nice. And it was super to go to a gig. I haven't been to a gig for a long time. I don't think, anyway. And it was the most produced gig I've ever been to by a factor of 10 to 100. Like, it was just insanely produced. I spent a lot of time just watching how they were managing to go from one set piece to another. Really fluid, really well managed, really kind of like, okay, during this bit, we're both going to be on this bit of the stage, and then during this bit, I'm going to be at the back. And because the stage setup was kind of unconventional, it's kind of had this looped catwalk and the band at the back. It's like a 5-piece live band playing with this, which in itself is really impressive. And then, like, so tight management of where the two artists were going to be at any given time, how they were going to interact and all of that. And they're also really loving it. I should say, this is a home crowd. These guys are from Oslo. The gig sold out, that gig sold out that particular night in 12 minutes. And yeah. Spectrum is a big venue.
And I had 3 of them, I think.
They did 3, yeah. Yeah. The first one sold out in like 4 hours, a second in an hour, and the Saturday night sold out in 12 minutes. So, like, you can tell what kind of crowd this is going to be, right? This is like, everyone loves these guys. And they were so happy to be there. And it was great. It was such a positive gig. And I was very interested to see what kind of people would be there. Was it just going to be people like me and my boss and my other colleague and my boss's wife and their friends who are all like, 40-ish? Like, was it going to be that? I was really surprised. I was a little bit surprised, actually. It was probably at least 2/3 women. But the age range was quite wide. The youngest people were actually kids. There was a family who brought their small kids with, and they had ear protectors because, it was quite a loud gig. So these two kind of dorky looking kids with ear protectors on, and they showed the camera pans over there to see them, and they were like maybe 5, maybe 6, That was awesome. There were maybe a few words they maybe shouldn't have heard at that age, but Norway seems to be, we haven't talked about swearing, like we'll do that episode another day, but Norway seems to be pretty loose about that. There were bits that I thought maybe would have been slightly frightening for them, but they were kind of a little bit kind of camp and tongue-in-cheek as well. So sort of, I guess. I hope they had fun. Everybody had fun. Everybody had a really good time. It was super positive, very, very warm and friendly. And it wasn't, when I say rap or hip-hop or things like that, I imagine that conjures pictures of a certain kind of narrative. And Carpe Diem are very much not that. so increasingly, like, I think when they were growing up and when they were starting, there were sort of like a lot of, let's go get drunk, let's drive the rispus around a little bit. There's some of that. One of them is a Muslim, it's complicated. But there, a lot of it is talking about growing up brown, in quotes, growing up Muslim in Norway. So very non-conventional. One of them's parents came from the Indian subcontinent. I can't remember exactly where. The other one grew up Muslim in Norway, which is, you know, traditionally not that way oriented. And so they talk a lot about that experience, what it's like, and the fear of, like, what's going to happen to me as a kind of visibly non, quote unquote, Norwegian person. Am I going to be arrested for just for the color of my skin? And they talk a lot about that aspect of sort of social justice, but in a very consumable way. Like, it's enjoyable to listen to, it's fun to listen to, but there is a point, and they have a point, and they execute it extremely well. So it was kind of a really fun mix of stuff that is just fun, stuff that has a point, stuff that is fun to sing along to, stuff that is fun to wave your mobile phone around to. It was great. It was a really, really fun gig, and I can see why it got the good reviews that it got. And I'm not even like a huge fan. Like, presumably almost every other person in that room was a super fan to be there. Oh, and they got a girl up on stage who turns out to be someone that, I can't remember who it is. Someone's daughter, someone who used to work with. But they got her up. I don't know how they got her up or why they got her up from the kind of slightly more VIP area to sing with them for a track. I don't know whether it was just random. She was clearly really into it. And then they pulled her up on stage and they got her to kind of sing along as well. And like, she took the mic for a verse and she nailed it. She was great. She just went all in. And then after, she cried. She was really like emotional. She was like, oh my God, I can't believe this just happened to me. You know, like, it was a pure TV moment basically. But she really went for it, and that was awesome as well. So it's just like positive vibes all around. It was great.
I think they made a recording of this, so this might be available.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah, so cool.
It was great.
Yeah.
I would recommend.
You could actually use their lyrics as sort of kind of a litmus test for how integrated you are, because they contain many references to
Oslo, actually.
Yeah, Oslo, and but also popular culture in Norway.
Yeah,
that stretches far a bit back.
I need to go through, like, and spend a bit more time listening to the stuff. I'll link in particular to one track, which translates as "It's easy to be a rebel in your basement flat," basically, which is about the experience of racism in Norway. And there's kind of lovely hooks that recur about. That people have said things, sort of racist casual commentary, like, you know, oh, is this what my taxes are paying for? And, oh, it's you who's taking my daughter to the cinema tonight, kind of thing. And it's a really humanizing way to sort of think about, okay, here's someone who's having a very different experience of Norway than I am. It's great.
Cool.
Two thumbs.
Not free.
Ding.
Let's close off with your word of the week.
Right. Mine is Alt Mulig Mann, Everything Possible Man. I went to the Fram Museum. We had a visitor and we went to Fram, which is the museum which is about polar exploration. And they got an actual ship that's over 100 years old that got used for exactly that. And it's great. And if you're a nerd for this, and everyone should be, like, go and read Ernest Shackleton's book, South. It is the business. That's not my cultural pick of the week, but it could be. It's great. Read that and then go to the Fram Museum, and then, like, your appreciation of what is happening will just be tenfold better. Alt Mulig Mann is someone who can do all things, I guess. It's like someone who will just do whatever. So it literally breaks down as everything possible man or person. But it's a word that I saw on a shiny metal plaque in the ship to describe someone's job on board, which I guess was kind of dog's body or jack of all trades or whatever. But I liked it as a word.
Yeah, it's a cool word.
Mm.
It's like being a potato, as they say.
Yeah, we need briefly, right? Means that you don't. I had to ask about being a potato, because it's a thing that people say here, and what it means is that you can do several things, but none of them brilliantly, right? You're kind of well rounded, but without necessarily having one special talent.
I guess you could have that connotation, but not that, necessarily.
That was how it was given to me.
By whom?
Anya.
She has no idea of what.
So
that's her own insecurity. No.
Ouch.
No, I'm sorry. I don't know. I have heard it without that. It can also be that you are just generally good with many things and can do
it's,
them.
It's not a flattering word. Potato.
It depends on what you think about potatoes, I guess.
Well, I like a potato as much as anyone, but the thing in the UK, like jack of all trades, the other half of that sentence is master of none.
Yeah.
And that's the implication here also, no?
Perhaps I should prefix it with a Renaissance potato.
Title.
Polymath chip.
That's great. Oh, that's super. Do you think we should go to work?
Yeah.
Yeah, me too.
Will it be the folklore episode next week?
You got time?
Actually, I will have.
All right. I got a 7-hour train ride back to Oslo tonight, so maybe I should spend some of that reading folklore.
That's
all right.
Ha det bra. Takk for at du hørte på.
Ha det bra.